Hey, you listening to this podcast right now. If you want to dip your toe into the lake of somatics and my work and hang out with me and my team in real time, join us in our community somatics sessions. I host these every other month. They are virtual, they are by donation only, and they are accessible to a global audience of bodies that are looking to relate to themselves on a deeper level. It's really quite easy. All you have to do is click on the link, register for free, and during the session, we'll give you an option to donate or not. The choice is yours. Either way, I hope you come and join us.
The next Community Somatics will be held on Tuesday, June 4th at 5 p.m. EDT. The meeting will be an hour long, and if you register, you'll automatically receive a replay after it's concluded.
Something I've been playing with somatically is noticing in my body the part that becomes constricted or anxious, and the idea of like, what if this happens? What if this person leaves me? What if I don't have access to the substance? Da, 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 da. And then I can also notice a part that doesn't feel that activation. And I've also been playing with the wording, even if this person leaves me, even if I don't have this substance. And for me, the what if speaks to the anxious or the avoidant style, again, that anxiety, whereas even if feels very secure to me. Again, coming back to that self-security, even if XYZ happens, fundamentally, I know I'll be okay.
Welcome to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast, where we explore life through the lens of somatics. I'm Luis Mujica, a somatic educator who teaches people how to find safety in themselves. Your turn to learn begins now. So welcome back to the pod. You listeners, welcome back. I'm here with my team, and we realized in 2 weeks our course closes for registration. So currently, while you're seeing this, there are 2 weeks left to register. And I thought we could open by just talking a little bit about what somatics has gifted us, what our favorite things are about the course, anything we want people to know who are thinking about signing up. And Camille, I want to start with you because you were saying about, and oh, I want to say, those of you listening, we're going to get into attachment styles in a moment. So we're going to talk a little bit about the course, then we're going to go into the somatics of attachment styles. So Camille, tell me what you were saying, because I said to you, you were a brain on legs, and then you said, yes, I am. And I said, so how did somatics impact you?
Yeah. I'm a brain on legs. I tend to be more of an analytical, strategic thinker. And as such, as emotions, reading my own as well as other people has tended to be difficult for me. Like I don't know what other people are feeling. Hell, I sometimes don't know what I'm feeling. And when you think about traditional therapy, a lot of it is focused on affect, emotion, or meaning. And that was just always lost on me. What was so refreshing when I was introduced with somatics is that it might be difficult for me to know if I'm feeling sad or happy or frustrated or annoyed, but it's really tangible for me to know, oh, my heart rate is racing, or it's really tangible for me to feel like, oh, my belly feels warm and open and really soft, or I know my feet feel cool in a good way and I like pressing them into the floor. Or if I look at this picture on the wall, I can feel like a flood coming up my back. Oh, and this, that reminds me of such and such time. Like that was easy for me to connect with. And through connecting to those physical sensations, which were much more tangible and salient to me, I could then begin to notice emotion. I could then begin to notice, oh, and sadness is coming up when I'm with this, or oh, this is joy, or this is empowerment, or this is strength. So I could begin to feel or give word to affects or emotion, which seems to be easier for other people.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. What about you, Marika? What was the shift that you, I mean, you said many shifts over the years, but what have you really noticed, or what's alive for you now as you hear Camille?
I love the brain on legs. That's not my experience. I feel like I'm like a swimming pool without legs. It's The thing that's really been so present for me when I've been thinking about how the course has changed my life is how my yeses are all authentic now, which is really a big deal. And so are my no's. Mm-hmm. But also, I can sit with so much discomfort now. And I didn't think that that was a goal. I didn't think that was something I needed. I didn't realize how much I was bypassing those things or just feeling stuff. And that has just been a whole, you know, it's changed my relationships. It's changed my relationship with myself. It's changed how I show up in the world, and enough that people have been like, what's different about you? You know, or what happened or what's going on, you know, where I get to actually like share this work with people. And it comes to you when it comes to you, really. Like, I was 42, I think, when we met. 41, 41, 42, something like that. And I really just thought, I guess I'm just going to be uncomfortable like this for the rest of my life. Like, I'm just not going to know how to be with people. I'm not going to know how to go to a job for more than a year. I'm not going to know how to maintain relationships. And all that's changed. And I actually think that I felt like I knew how to do that before, but I didn't know how to do it embodied.
Mm, yeah, that's a good distinction. Yeah. I love that. That's really beautiful. Yeah. What about you, Evan?
I really resonate that, especially with the brain on legs. Really feel that too. Because I feel like somatics changed so much my perspective on things where, for example, I mean, I was into meditation for a while and I was so focused on the thoughts, and it was like I literally would completely forget I had a body in meditation. And I would even be sitting and I'd be experiencing discomfort, and I'd be like, well, this is the way I'm supposed to sit. I'm focusing on my thoughts. And to be able to even to go and sit again and even notice what's happening, not just in my thoughts, but in my entire body, I feel like really shifted things. And then really being able to approach it, and this is you talk about in the course a lot, being able to approach sensations relationally was so big for me, because especially since I was so much in that thinking place, I was always trying to figure it out. I was like, well, I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with me or figure out why I don't feel well. And when it would come to the sensations, it would just be this big wave that I didn't even know what to do with. So I think the work is also, kind of getting practice with somatics and getting used to feeling big sensations, and really it's sinking in, not just to my mind, but to my body, that if I have a big sensation, it's not going to kill me. Was really, really revolutionary.
Yeah, I want to highlight that having a big sensation is not going to kill me. You know, a lot of the things we talk about today and that we talk about a lot of times, it really comes down to that, doesn't it? The clarity that something really big is completely normal, nothing's going wrong, and your body actually knows what to do with it. But when you're raised to avoid that or repress it or ignore it or numb out from it, then you have no way to, like you said, relate to it. So I really appreciate that. I just felt like asking you, Camille, how did you find somatics? Was it through Tending the Roots, or was there something before that?
It was kind of a little before that. I will say, like, formally, like the word somatics, it was through Tending the Roots, but I actually started a business container where it was kind of like a course and a masterclass-ish thing, but the first chunk of the course was all about, they didn't use the word, but it was about somatics, like helping you physically begin to feel like, how does it feel to think about saying working the way you're currently working? Think about what you'd like to do. How do you notice your body shift? And I remember thinking, like, this is bullshit. I came here to get to the real business stuff. I'm trying to walk away from a 15-year corporate career. I need to get to the real stuff. So it was really interesting that my intro to somatics wasn't even with the formal word somatics, but yeah. So that's how
and
I
you
came
resisted
to it.
And then
I resisted it at first. But I will say, even as I got into it, in that course, in that masterclass, I was like, oh, I kind of like this. Oh my gosh, yes. It does feel so much better to think about doing this. Oh, I can feel that. I noticed my chest just completely opened up when I thought about not working on Mondays or not having to answer the stupid emails. But then, yeah, just continued to snowball when I had the chance to participate in Tending the Roots. And then, yeah. So it's all kind of kismet.
I was curious, because, you know, I already knew Evan and Marika before. And so I just curious how you even found us. That's cool. Yeah. Well, you know, I was going to say something that I think I'm going to save for a navigating, but I'll say the brief part is I talked to you the other day, Camille, about this, the difference between being disliked and being misunderstood. And I think what I've loved about the teaching the course, because I developed all these things, so you'd think that I just know it, but this stuff kind of comes through you when you're a creative person. And then when you have the pleasure of reteaching it over and over and over again, I think this is the 14th one or something, you really get to hear this. You get to witness your own philosophies. You get to see how people respond to them. You get to refine things over the years. And I think over couplings, I'm just so conscious of them in a way I've never been before, from teaching about them so much and from seeing people shift when they understand the difference. And so I've been noticing recently, the more public I become, how there's this trigger in me. It's a soft one. It's not as big as it used to be, but it's definitely alive around being misunderstood. And for a while, I thought it was being disliked. I put that those were overcoupled, but actually, I don't mind being disliked. I've been disliked since I was in elementary school. You know, I've had a lot of practice with that. But the misunderstood piece has its own lineage in my body, which, like I said, I'll go into in another session. I don't know if that's going to be before or after this. So everyone, if it's not before this, you haven't heard that one already, it's coming up. But I do encourage all of you listening to join this course. You have 2 weeks. You have all of us for seven. You have 2 weeks to join. You have all of us in the course for 7 weeks, doing it with you, teaching you, supporting you. And I'm doing two this year. So the one coming up on April 8th, and the next one, which will be sometime in September. We'll see when. But I'm excited for this topic because it always lights me up to put something that's usually Eurocentric psychology through a somatic lens. It really gives us a more, I would say, ancient isn't even the right word, but like a human, just a human, simple, humanized version of, let's say, identities that can make us feel bad about ourselves. And so today we're talking about the attachment styles. And the attachment styles are, you were saying, Evan, something about the testing and how someone would take a test online and they'll get, you know, avoidant style. And they'll think, oh, fuck, I'm avoidant for life. And I just don't see it that way. I see attachment styles being relational and environmental. So let's think of them as attachment expressions or attachment patterns rather than attachment styles. So it's an expression that emerges in response to a relationship. So I'm just going to go through the main ones: avoidant, secure, anxious, ambivalent. Now, I know there's a bunch of sub ones. I'm just going to stick with those four. So if we think of the avoidant attachment style, we think of someone, just like the name suggests, who avoids, who isolates, quote, fear of intimacy. Through a somatic lens, what we're really talking about with avoidant styles are nervous systems that get very overwhelmed by other bodies. It's just that simple. Whether it's a body being really kind to you and you don't have capacity for intimacy, or you don't believe you deserve it and it scares you and your body runs away, or bodies that are really needy and asking for a lot. And Camille and I were talking about this last week because her and I are both, we vacillate between secure and avoidant. And so could you explain what we were saying about the avoidant one? Like, what triggers your avoidant tendency?
Yeah. I'll say, like, overwhelm in general can trigger my avoidant tendency. So it could be overwhelm at work or, you know, heavy traffic. But one of the big triggers, one of the things that really caused me overwhelm is like, it is neediness, like in particular, and it seems really small, but like when people say, I just need some words of encouragement or words of support. Oh, I shut down. I go into freeze because I don't know what, again, like going back, emotions, like what are those? I don't know what that means. Tell me what you need and I can deliver that. But like for it to be so opaque and subjective, then I go into avoidance. Yeah.
I'm just laughing. Like, emotions, what are those? I don't know how to help you. And I'm like, what's your job here? Oh, you're the community manager. You help people with trauma. Like, why did Luis hire her? You know, because you have this ability to go right to the point of the situation. And most people in our space feel super supported by you. So I'm even curious, how do you experience being avoidant in that expression when you're overwhelmed? Yet you literally answer hundreds of questions a week when we do the course. Like, explain that to me.
Honestly, I think it is sort of my superpower. I think whether we call it my avoidant tendency or my autism, I think part of the reason I gravitated towards diversity, equity, inclusion, towards trauma work is that the content itself does not make me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I like talking about systemic racism, marginalization, trauma. Let's talk about it. I am not overwhelmed by the content. What can overwhelm me is, like I said, if it's like, I need you to do this emotional, ambiguous thing for me. I don't know what it is, but we can absolutely talk about the history, the philosophy. I'm curious to know, like, what do you think? Like, we can have, I can absolutely facilitate that kind of conversation and hold what for a lot of people would perceive as like heavy, dark, overwhelming topics.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you say that, I'm actually seeing how much of an asset that is for us, because you don't get easily enmeshed with people. But if yes. you, right? But if you felt that need to meet everyone's emotional needs, there could be a lot of enmeshment, and that wouldn't be very supportive, would it?
Oh, not at all. Like, I would be completely overwhelmed in this space if I internalized everybody's experience as my own, or I internalized their experiences as mine personally to fix. So and there are some people who, you know, I've gotten to be, oh, you can be cold, you can be distant, and that's okay, and so be it. But then for a lot of folks, like you said, oh, this sort of style allows me to hold people in this space.
It's funny, because when most people I know that have the avoidant tendency tend to attract people with the anxious tendency.
Yeah.
So our partners and our friends usually have what we call an anxious attachment style, like I'm playing with here, anxious expression, which just means I'm trying to play with these words as I go on, like low capacity, because low, mm-hmm. high, there's this value attached to these. But let's just say there's a inability or a difficulty, but difficulty I like better, to be with sensation as it comes up in your body. So it propels you, that sensation of discomfort propels you even away from your own experience towards someone else to soothe you. Mm-hmm. And that tends to be what we call anxious attachment. That's not who the person is. And like Evan was saying earlier, it doesn't damn you into having to be that expression for the rest of your life. This is just how your body knows at this point in your life how to manage stress relationally. And so I'm going to, as I say that, I wonder, actually, Marika, what do you tend to be? What do you test? As are you aware?
I haven't tested.
Based on what you're hearing, what do you think?
I just what was the last one?
Anxious?
No, ambivalent. I mean, I have been anxious.
Ambivalent. Yeah. Ambivalent is like, I say I want this, but I can't handle it when I get it. Like, I'm not really
sometimes
sure.
People refer to it as disorganized style.
Disorganized, too. Another one, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I can point at all of them and be like, yep. Depends on where I was in my life and who I was with.
That's the key.
I've definitely been with partners where it was like, I've never been like, I'll die without you, but definitely the anxiety of a little bit of either codependence or not knowing how to do things on my own, mm-hmm. And or not wanting to try new things on my own without somebody else. So mm-hmm. that feels like something that I definitely have done before. And what was the third one? I can't remember.
There's avoidant, secure, anxious, ambivalent.
Oh, yeah. When you said secure, I was like,
nope, never. Don't know what that feels like.
Yeah. Sounds nice.
we're going to play with that in a moment, that idea. Evan, what do you think you tend to express as?
I also didn't do the quiz, but I'm assuming it's anxious. Sounds about right. And I also think that, what always, because it tends to lean into the codependency. And I just love the way that you and I guess we teach about addiction, where it's that relationship and that searching for safety, and how that really, I think it's more obvious with anxious than it is with avoidant, but just how it kind of works with just trying to find some source of regulation.
So I want to highlight what he said there, some source of regulation. And yes, the anxious attachment style, the anxious expression, this is the one of addiction. So if you have an anxious attachment expression again, and when we say anxious attachment, we mean your relationship to how you attach, how you connect to other people is propelled by anxiety, is propelled by security, is propelled by avoidance, is what these terms really mean. What I like about them, and we have a fantastic psychologist,
that's in our space named Malvina. And she had brought up that she sees this as a pattern, a good way to identify patterns. And that's really the beauty of attachment styles. They teach your patterns, things that might be unseen that you might not have words for. That's what all this identity is really good for. It gives you a name for some kind of movement or pattern or expression that you just don't have words for. However, we get really identity obsessed and we start playing with, I'm avoidant, I'm secure, I'm anxious. It's like, always? Are you sure? And when we get really identified with that and we start even kind of like fighting for that style, then we lose our multidimensionality in relationships and we lose the understanding that most of these are really healthy expressions. So go ahead, give me a see that thing.
Well, yeah, they're healthy. Okay, so I'm trying to get my thoughts together. sorry,
this is
swarming here. Yeah. So for me, these actually are not all disparate manifestations. Like if we look up or look at some of the definitions of secure, one aspect is independent. But then if you look at avoidant, it says hyper independent. And then again, you go back to secure, it says able to rely on others for support. And then you go to anxious, overly reliant on people for support. So for me, secure isn't so much that it's not avoidant or it's not anxious. It's, if we think about it, like in terms of regulation, it's being in that happy, health, quote unquote, healthy middle where we oscillate back and forth between avoidant, between anxious, and not going to these peaks and valleys, these extremes, but just really playing it in that middle. So yeah, that just came up.
Oh, that's for real. That's exactly what it is. Because when we understand this as a healthy response, just like trauma response, just like, you know, people will come into the course or they'll come work with us and they'll think self-regulation is just, that's the cherry on the icing. Yep. And it's great, or cherry on the top of the sundae. That's sometimes icing, depends what you're eating. I used to eat a banana split cake and there were cherries on the icing. But people think that's what they're striving for. But they're all these beautiful ways of the body managing stress. So we don't put co-regulation up here and auto-regulation down here and self-regulation over there. We realize, well, what's showing itself now? Oh, I'm auto-regulating while I watch TV. I'm avoiding and isolating and numbing out slightly. So I can just get a little break from these sensations. How beautiful. And then when I have the break, then I move into co-regulation and I move into some self-relating. It's the same thing here. Oh, my avoidant expression is emerging. I find myself shutting down with this person. I find myself not calling this person back. I find myself staying in the house for a couple of days and not going out. That's telling me my body is very relationally overwhelmed. What do I need to support my system so I can move out of that overwhelm into connecting when I'm ready? So it helps us identify our patterns rather than get stuck in the identity of which one means what and that we have it for life. And you know, I was interested in this idea of the secure attachment because I was saying this the other night in our membership and I was really moved by people's shares and questions around it. That I guess I'll start by saying, let's all try this. What does secure attachment mean to you? When you hear that, not even what it actually, no right or wrong, but what does it mean to you? How have you experienced it or how have you not?
What comes up for me is I want, but don't need you.
Nice.
That's pretty much, that's what I was thinking as well. Where it's, I also was thinking that I'm securely attached to myself so that I can have a healthy attachment to you.
Yeah, I feel like for me, I really have a hard time with it because I feel like so much of this is so subjective and so fluid that I don't even feel like I can put a name to it.
Can you put a feeling to it?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's much, just like a state of like settled kind of resting.
I think that's the interesting part because we think of, again, think of avoidance, think of anxiousness. There's urgency with both of those usually. If I'm kind of like run, if someone comes up to me, I need you. And I feel that pull back, that flight response, which avoidance and flight response are very much intertwined usually. There's an urgency behind that. It's not like an easy, slow unfolding of running and hiding. There's a constriction, a tension, anxiousness, anxious attachment expressions. I'm propelled toward the person to soothe me. So there's a bit of a panic until I can get the thing that soothes me. And I think we can have anxious attachment with food, right? With substances, with TV, with money. It's not just human experiences or human relationships. So I do find that when we're talking about secure attachment, we're talking about it somatically, there's an ease, there's an urgency that just isn't there in the relational field. That's the important piece. And this is where I want to get into the nuance about this, about the security idea. So like Marika said, self-attached, there's a security in my attachment to myself. That really interests me. And I guess my experience of that is I have trust in myself that I can experience and go to certain places within me. And even if I can't handle it, I know I'll be okay. I know I can even ask for help. I can call a friend. I know I can use my agency. So there's a security within my own connection to myself that's just like I rest into that. And then from there, I don't put as much on my relationships because if someone's unavailable or they disappoint me, I don't keep going to them for the hit of comfort. I just go right back to me. And I guess I just wonder if there's a fine line between that and avoidance. How can that turn into isolation compared to how can that become a way to connect really beautifully without the anxiousness? Hey, my friends. I created a space that is affordable, accessible, and anyone is allowed to join anytime, and it's called the Library Membership. The Library Membership is an online private platform that hosts dozens of my webinars, my somatic practices, private mini lectures, and movement practices. There's also a monthly sound healing, and you'll be invited to a weekly Tuesday live mini practice with me and other participants. You'll also be invited to be a live audience member in our monthly HLN team podcast recordings, where you'll take place in the Q&A that happens off air after the episode is filmed. For more information on this membership, click on the link below or go to holisticlifenavigation.com and click on membership and then library. You can join right now and you can cancel or pause your subscription at any time. I look forward to seeing you in there.
I see the difference as being when I'm in a secure place, I can allow for that nuance versus if I'm in a purely avoidant place, it's the mindset of I can't trust anybody. I can't ask anybody for help versus if I'm in a secure place and I'm realizing, okay, I'm a little past capacity. I could use some help. Let me check in with this person or this organization or source, see if they have the capacity to help me out. If they don't, I'll still be okay. But if they do, okay, great. And so that's the distinction for me.
Mm-hmm. For me, it would, I mean, yes, absolutely. And then where I went was, am I feeling secure? Sorry, can you repeat that again? It just went out of my mind.
Yeah, secure attachment with self.
Right, with self. I feel like then I don't have to, I feel like it's a privilege to be able to reach out and ask for support. Like when I'm isolated, I'm not asking for any support. You know, doesn't even occur to me, you know.
That's a good distinction because secure attachment to self, it's much easier to reach out. You don't really avoid people when there's a security. Especially again, security with self in terms of if something goes wrong with this person, I can handle that. Right. So if there's a security in yourself to deal with the anxiety, the activation, whatever comes up from a rupture, you're not going to be pulled back relationally. But if there lacks that security, then you're probably going to have the avoidant expression of I remove myself or I avoid you. And I think what we're really talking about with avoiding and with anxious attachment expressions is charge, is activation. You know what? I think at the end of the day, we're really talking about what's the relationship to activation, to go back to what Evan said about the course earlier. Do we have a secure, an avoidant, an ambivalent, an anxious attachment style to our sensations, to our activation?
Yeah, for me, I was having agency and urgency. being the two words that were coming up. But it's like, is there an urgency? I feel like an anxious, it's like an urgency to move towards, or is there an avoidant urgency to move away from? Or as opposed to, I even feel like it's a kind of even a way to kind of test it. It's like noticing like how much agency, like where am I feeling, how much agency do I feel like I have capacity for? Can even kind of.
Yeah, that's important, because a big experience somatically when you're triggered is your body believes it doesn't have agency. Because when you're triggered or overcoupled, your body's being reminded of a past situation where you didn't have it. And so the biggest trick is, in this moment, I feel like I have no agency. But most of the time, we have complete agency and power in response to the situation, yet the body doesn't feel that way. So then we start shutting down and going into freeze. And avoidant expressions are usually connected to freeze as well. There's a lot of shutdown in the avoidant type because we tend to isolate, get overwhelmed with sensation, and then we have to numb out and dissociate a little bit. I'm interested in this want versus need, because that's really a beautiful way to understand the difference between what I've said before with addiction, whether it's to people or to substance, abstinence and recovery. Big difference, right? You can abstain from something for 40 years. It doesn't mean you recovered, because recovery means it enters my life and my body's habitual pattern doesn't emerge. Another pattern is optional, right? And the habitual pattern might still be there. Like, I drink and it soothes me, so I need to drink more. That might be the habitual pattern. And I might drink and notice I get soothed, and there's still that part of me that wants to drink more, but I know, I can get a hug, or I can go journal, or I can take a bath, or I can dance, or I can call a friend, right? Other things emerge. That's what I call recovery. Whereas when you're in addiction and you're abstaining from something, you're being really responsible, because usually the thing we're addicted to that we're abstaining from is potent. So it can kill you, it can hurt you, it can rob you of your money, your life, your friendships, it can really destroy your life. So abstinence is very healthy. I'm not telling people not to abstain, but I think it's good to notice, well, when I abstain, under the abstinence, there's still the pattern. It just goes to Coca-Cola, or goes to candy, or goes to coffee, or goes to money. It goes somewhere else. And I guess I'm just saying that because the want versus need. If I want a piece of candy, that is such a different relational style with the candy than I need the candy. Everyone listening to this, just feel into your body and think of something you believe you need, whether you do or not. Just think of it. Notice the places that tense up in your body compared to thinking, I want. Can even say it out loud, you'd be like, I need a piece of cake, even if it isn't true. Everyone's like, Luis, all you're doing is talking about cake. It's like, oh, it's always my go-to, right? You know, my history was eating disorders. So if you feel into the, I need the cake, ooh, tension, but I'm like, I want the cake. Ooh, that feels nice. Let's riff on that a little bit.
I feel like there's a thing with the needing, you know, that when I need something, where especially if it's like something that is like food or drugs or, you know, that type of a thing, when there's a bracing in there, I think, for when especially with abstinence, if they haven't really dealt with overcoupling or the root, that there's still sort of this hypervigilance of like making sure I'm not around it, making sure I don't go into bars, making sure there's no food in the house, you know. And that's removed, at least for me. That's the thing that's kind of removed for me if I'm just wanting something.
You know?
Like, and it's part of an experience rather than it's feeding a need, you know.
That's a great distinction, because that there's that. This is great because it works on both sides. It's like if I'm addicted and I need cocaine, right? And I show up to the cocaine, there's always a tension, even when I'm getting my need met from the cocaine. If you think about this relationally with humans, it might be easier. Like, I need my wife, I need her to feel safe. And we might even make this a mistake, this as a secure attachment. Like, we love each other, we feel very safe with each other. But if there's an anxiety under my relationship with her, that phrase we hear, I don't know what I would do without you, is that really a secure attachment? Is that really a want versus a need? I get curious about that. And then you're flipping the script. If I'm abstaining, this just as if I was addicted, there's still a tension of I have to avoid this thing. So abstinence and avoidance, interesting, these things we're looking at here. The anxious attachment is addiction, right? We're seeing that reflected. And we're seeing the avoidant attachment expression with abstaining. So I'm just liking how this is coming together. Ooh, pregnant pause. Do you want me to fill pregnant it in or someone pause. Else going to fill it in?
I'll go for it.
birth the silence, birth it out.
Yeah. Something I've been playing with somatically is noticing in my body the part that becomes constricted or anxious, and the idea of like, what if this happens? What if this person leaves me? What if I don't have access to the substance? Da, 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 da. And then I can also notice a part that doesn't feel that activation. And I've also been playing with the wording, even if this person leaves me, even if I don't have this substance. And for me, the what if speaks to the anxious or the avoidant style, again, that anxiety. Whereas even if feels very secure to me, again, coming back to that mm-hmm. self-security, even if XYZ happens, fundamentally, I know I'll be okay. Or even if I end up all alone, I'll be all alone. I can do whatever the fuck I want to in my house. I haven't been able to do that in how many years. So I don't, that's
avoidant
something
that fantasy. Live that avoidant fantasy, Camille.
Yes.
No, I love that. We were talking about that, I think, last week in our our closing of our parenting group. About how, you know, for so long you've shared in our spaces how you had this meditation with your boys for the longest time. Like, even if some violence occurs and they perish, I will grieve and I know I'll be okay. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we know from this podcast, those of you listening, you know, Camille had a beautiful daughter and she was born with Down syndrome and a heart defect or heart mm-hmm. condition, we'll call it. And went into cardiac arrest right in front of you. So like these years of this practice of non-attachment, and then there you go in the moment, you're practicing yeah. it with her in that moment. I guess I wanted to bring that up and get your input, because just like people think embodiment means calm, I think people think secure attachment means unfazed. And I couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah.
For me, secure attachment means I securely attach to what's in me, my grief, my anger, my pain, my pleasure, my joy, like all of it I have a secure relationship with. And if I don't, then I repair that. How do you experience secure attachment while you were potentially losing Khadija? Explain that so people don't get this idealistic idea.
Yeah. Let's absolutely talk about that. Because even before my experience with Khadija, like through the meditation, like I literally sat down and said, what would happen if I got a call right now that said, your son has been killed? And I literally wanted myself to walk through. Well, the first thing that I felt in my body was that I probably dropped to my knees and let out this guttural cry. Mm. And I just sat with that for a moment. That's what I would do. And then I realized, oh, wait, I got to call Justin and let him know. And then we probably have to go to the hospital and claim his body. You know, like I'm literally walking yeah. through the steps. And then like I got to plan the funeral. And then what would I be doing a week after funeral, 2 weeks after the funeral? So I say all that to say, like, the same thing happened with Khadija. So when she's in the midst of the cardiac arrest, I'm in active freeze because there's nothing for me to do other than to watch. After she's stabilized, I take a moment for myself to go to the chapel and I let out this deep guttural moan and cry. And there were times, particularly over the course of the first 4 days when it was the most touch and go, where I would need to go to the chapel and moan and groan and let all of the anguish and the potential fear about what if she dies and I have to call Justin and then I have to call everybody else and all just letting it come up. And what was really interesting during that time was that I could witness it from a place of curiosity, but I was also in judgment of myself. Mm. Like there was the part, just like you said, the part that said, no, you're supposed to be completely non-attached. You should be okay with whatever it is. And the reality is I knew that even if she died, I would be okay. Mm-hmm. And I'm still going to grieve. I'm going to moan and mm-hmm. groan. I'm going to express. Those things are not mutually exclusive.
I'm really loving this because I've been on really fascinated lately with our use of the word regulation. You know, I've told you all this, and I've been playing with this, and I'm going to play with it even more in this next course, more than I ever have. Because in the somatic circle, in the somatic field, which is getting very popular in mainstream, as things get mainstream, they lose their nuance. It's just, yeah, they have to be to get digestible. But there's such a deep nuance around the term regulation. And I teach regulation through an animistic lens. So it's not something you're doing to your body. It's a result from a connection you're having with your body. So your body naturally regulates or modulates rather than you regulate it. Yet a lot of people come with a desire to learn regulation techniques. Like everyone wants to learn how to regulate themselves, which I think is brilliant on one hand. Like we want to know how to respond to something big. However, it's just repression being repackaged as this somatic liberation, when really there's nothing liberating about having to regulate every unpleasant thing in your body. There's still a tension then in response to unpleasant sensations that I now need to regulate. And I'm just saying that because what you experience, that vast and that judgment of I should be non-attached. Non-attachment for me means I'm not attached to an outcome, but I still feel it, right?
Yes.
Like I'm not arguing the reality, but I feel the reality. Very different.
Yeah.
Whereas when we hear non-attached, we think detached. And then we think exactly undercoupled, essentially. I don't feel anything. I'm not responding to what's happening in front of me. I don't call things out that are harmful to people. And it just couldn't be further from the truth, could it?
Yeah, no, completely. And I will say that was a distinction in what I was experiencing. Like I didn't really have the experience of feeling constriction or being upset. Like, why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to her? This shouldn't be us. That wasn't part of it, which I feel would have further intensified what I was going through. It was just that, yep, she may be transitioning and I can moan and groan and be with that.
Mm. I love moan and groan in a healthy way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because we always say, oh, they're moaning and groaning.
Yeah.
But, you know, moan and groan, what a gorgeous modality.
Like, yeah.
It's the technology of the body, isn't it?
I know. I've talked about it here. Like, for me, regulation, like you said, we can think regulation is just being zen and stoic all the time. But for me, what is really helpful to remember is that regulation is an ebb and flow. It is an activation. It is a settling. It is an activation. It is a settling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the ocean has always been big for me. So just the connecting it to the wave and that ebb and flow oscillating back and forth between one side to the other. And so it's not either or, but it's being with both. So there absolutely were moments when during those four days where I seemed like really calm and I, because maybe I was settled. And then if you happened to walk in that chapel at that moment, you might have said, oh my God, she's completely nuts. And she, but I didn't feel dysregulated even in those moments. Like I felt like I could feel what I was doing. I felt really embodied. I felt myself drop to my knees. I felt the groan. I felt the tears. And then I felt, oh, now I'm ready to go back to the room. And it was just that knowing.
That's right. See, that's so gorgeous because with this obsession or infatuation or centering or regulating, we're then unconsciously or consciously also throwing shade at activation.
Yes.
Like we're seeing activation as the problem. Mm-hmm. Whereas activation is, I mean, the heart couldn't pump without activation. It is life force in and of itself. It's the, when we say modulating or we say regulating, and Evan, I'd love for you to tell the train story that you said to me the other day, that the regulating and modulating of the body, all it means is the body is like a shaman, knows exactly how much life force energy to dose you. And when you get too much life force energy, it knows how to move it out to release it a little bit. And it's this constant ebb and flow of life force coming in, hitting a certain window of tolerance, and then an expression as a result of too much life force, and then something settles. And that's back to these whole attachment styles. I avoid until something in me regulates, shifts, expresses, and then I go connect when I have more capacity. So the avoidance isn't a problem. It only becomes a problem if it's the only thing I know how to do and I stay in it. It is a medicine for me. What I've learned how to do is in the avoidance, I've learned to stop just auto-regulating. So in my history, I would avoid and isolate. And in the isolation, would do nothing to connect to myself. I would only do things to disconnect myself. So I'd be away from, let's say, my partner for 3 days. And then we get back together and immediately I'd be triggered and have to go away right away. Because I didn't build any capacity to relate because I was just isolating and auto-regulating. So just learning, how do I connect in the isolation? How is the isolation a medicine? Then you don't see the avoidant attachment style as an issue. If the anxiety of the anxious one propels you to somebody and you get hugged or you get soothed or you get loved, use that capacity to then relate to yourself. So then you're using your anxious attachment style for self-connection once you have the capacity. All this really comes down to is, if I don't have the capacity for security in myself, I let these you know, attachment styles emerge. I consciously follow them. I play with what I need to tend to my capacity. And then I self-relate. Then I connect to where I have security. And I think it's a beautiful way to use these without putting them on a hierarchy or feeling bad about them or trying to be one if you're the other. Just let it kind of move through your body how it moves through. But to go back, can you give us the metaphor about the train, Evan? I think that will help people understand activation.
Sure. Yeah, I have no idea where I learned the answer, where it came from, or why this even stuck in my head and came up the other day. But there is a part, and also I hope this is true, because I'm running off memory now.
I didn't look at my head. I don't care if it is. It's so good.
It's a beautiful metaphor anyway.
Yeah.
No, there's a part in a steam engine train called the regulator. And the regulator is a simple device that lets steam out when there's too much. So essentially what's happening is, you know, they're firing the coal. The cold's heating the water, it's creating the steam, but sometimes there's not enough steam, so the regulator is closed. So I feel like that was kind of like this undercoupled, like there's just not enough steam, but it's closed, so it's starting to build and it's starting to get there. And if there's too much, it opens and it lets the extra steam out. So it's, even though what's happening underneath is sometimes there's less and sometimes there's more, this regulator is kind of allowing for there to be a balance.
And that's what I want everyone to really get. If you think of what Evan just said, and you hear what Camille was saying, like when she said, if someone walked into that chapel, they would have thought I was losing my mind. She would have been if she wasn't embodied, because it would have been complete dissociation, and activation would then become dysregulation. But her activation was what her body needed to do to move her, to cry, to sob, to fall to the floor. And then something released, that sobbing released just enough that she was able to metabolize, feel herself again, and vacillate back to a place we would call more calm or grounded. So it's that ability to modulate big chunks of energy, right? Not by down-regulating them, not by pushing them away or just always hugging a pillow, which is great. I teach that and love that. But by letting it take over you. It's like a real practice in humility to let the activation take over your body and become an animal. You know, moaning and groaning is an animal instinct. So if we're able to have this fun dance between what my animal wants to do and what my conscious mind wants to do, I find so much balance emerging from that and so much humility and humanity, rather than just the animal instinct taking over. That's why people kill each other. And then just conscious mind taking over. That's Evan meditating till his bones break because he can't feel his legs because he's dissociated. So, you know, it's like we want to go between the two. I want to close with a question for all of us. How has this course that we teach, that we sit through, that we hear and witness people go through, how has it shifted how we relate to other people? Since we're talking about attachment styles, like what have we learned with capacity, handling other people, trigger, whatever, wherever you want to go with this? I'm going to keep plugging this course because I think it's just the best course out there right now. And I want everyone to check it out.
I wholeheartedly agree. Part of the reason I joined this team, because it was life changing for me. It was life changing in this respect, in that I was able to develop a tangible felt sense of my capacity, by which I mean I was able to develop a tangible felt sense of my boundaries, my desires, my preferences. And in having a tangible felt sense of those, I now have greater capacity for people because I'm not putting myself past capacity. Mm-hmm. Like I have very low capacity for people because I was overextending myself and I was putting myself past capacity. But because I can set boundaries, I can actually be with people more. And I tend to be more curious about them as opposed to judgmental because I'm not in this anxious state. So that's what has changed for me.
Love that.
One big thing that's changed for me, I was just thinking of an example from last night, which is I don't, when I'm at capacity, I don't see it as you need to change this thing because I'm uncomfortable. You need to, And the smallest example was, we were watching something last night, my husband and I, and I got very violent and I started hyperventilating. Like, and I didn't even notice it. And then he kind of was like, are you okay? And previously I would have been like, turn this off. Like, I don't want to watch this. Like, why do you want, you know, like you need to, because this is something we were watching that he wanted to watch. And it was just like, hey, I don't think I can do this. I'm going to go. Yeah. I need to remove myself. Like, you keep having fun and I'm going to go do another thing. Like, it's not, I would literally just get pressed because, you know, you didn't change the channel or whatever. So it was nice to be like, oh, it's me that needs a change of scenery. It's me that's activated. It's me that needs to remove myself. And we didn't get in a fight and it was great.
Mm. Brilliant.
And it's really the little things like that.
It is.
That have built up to be huge things in my life.
Well, there's 30 little things a day, right?
Exactly.
They're so much more impactful in these big moments every 10 years that happen. Like, the 30 things a day are much more important to me.
100%.
You haven't spilled a tea. Tell me all about Danny.
No, I was going to say, what strikes me about the course is that there's, I almost feel like there's two parts to it, where there's what it is that you're teaching and what's being taught and the exercises, the practices. And then there's the being with and witnessing other people in that process. And I feel like for me, it's like both things are super potent, where either someone shares something and I really feel it and empathize, maybe I've had a similar experience and it feels reaffirming that way, or someone shares about an experience that they're having, whatever they're going through while they're, you know, their history or something they're experiencing while they're in this group. And because it's trauma informed, but they're sharing about it in a way that you wouldn't hear otherwise. And it's just very eye opening to hear, you know, just the plethora of different experiences that people have. So it's very humanizing, I guess. It's very connective to be in that space with other people.
And how has that changed how you relate to other people, like in your personal life? Like, even any practices in the course or just that piece, like, how does it change how you relate to the world?
I just think so much of somatics just for me just gives me a deeper understanding. And so, like, so much of making the unconscious conscious in this work and giving an understanding to what's going on sensationally inside me and a reason, and that it's normal and probably even healthy as opposed to a problem, that so many different things have just really changed. Yeah, I mean, really my whole life, like, I don't even know where to pick a small thing. It's really, you know, expanded out into everything.
It really, I mean, everything I heard there, I'm really hearing this thread of what was unconscious before, I'm going to name capacity. Because that the biggest light bulb I see people when they take the course, people that follow me on Instagram for years and heard me say capacity a million times, then they take the course and they experience the difference. They feel what we're talking about with capacity. That's the light bulb moment, because that has been what's unconscious all this time. And Marika's example was perfect with that. Like, I would have made what I felt in my body about my husband's shortcomings. There would have been this like instantaneous reflection to say, you're wrong. You're doing something wrong. What's wrong with you? Because that's what the animal body does. It fights or flights. There's no other option. Yet when you get the conscious mind involved and it starts feeling capacity, and for me, it was always my shoulders. The moment my shoulders start coming up, or I start talking fast, that's my cue that, okay, I'm headed to a place where my capacity is getting lowered. I'm getting too activated. My body's not able to metabolize what it's experiencing. And relationally, that's just like all of you said, that's everything. Because if I don't have that conscious relationship to capacity, I immediately, two things happen. I blame everyone around me for how I feel, and I empower them to change my experience. Because when people hear it, like Marika say, I would have made it about him, now I realize it's me. Some people aren't going to like that. Well, that's bullshit. Sometimes it is the other person. Sometimes it is the other person. And are you empowering them for your peace? Or do you have your own agency in response to what they're doing to find your peace? For me, when I'm connected to that agency and that capacity, I can feel my body says, walk away, cross your arms, close the door, don't answer the phone, give a hug, you know, all these different ways my body wants to reach out or pull back from someone. Again, this anxious avoidant play we're doing. When capacity is conscious and I understand it somatically, there is so much rupture I get to avoid and so much rupture I get to understand. Because when someone ruptures with me, even when they say, I don't like you anymore, which happens to me at least once a year at this point, I don't like you anymore. I'm not going to talk to you anymore because I don't fawn anymore. So people don't get the story of me they want to get who I am. When they decide they don't like me anymore, I hear they don't have the capacity for me right now. And that doesn't absolve me from my actions. I still greatly consider, I think I call Camille every time someone cancels me. I'm like, Camille, this person canceled me. Can you give me some accountability? Marika, Evan, I call all of you. And I'm like, this person said this. Can you tell me what am I missing? Because I really also want to know what I'm doing that I might not notice. And I'm seeing it as they're at capacity for me. So I don't take it personally anymore. We have a couple minutes. Does anyone want to jump in on that capacity piece or riff about that?
Well, that last piece there for me goes to the difference between receiving feedback and seeking approval. You know, I think I've talked about it in a previous podcast episode, but when we're seeking approval, we reflexively acquiesce to any sort of critique we may get. Oh, you didn't like that? Let me not do that anymore. Versus when we receive feedback, it is a much slower unfurling. We sit with it, like you said, mic check other people, and we just see if it's in alignment with what our desires or what our capacities are. And if it is, okay, I'll make that change. And if it's not, I don't have to make that change either.
Mm-hmm. I love that last part, because to me, that's the humility experience. Instead of not taking accountability or fawning, there's the, this might be really valuable for me. Let me feel it.
Yep.
And I think, like, for me, it's like 50-60% of the time, like, wow, they're spot on. I'm going to work with that part of myself. And it grows me. The rupture grows me instead of shames me now. And other times I'm like, nope, that's not for me. I can't do this thing they want me to do. I can't be what they want me to be. I'm okay with that. Because again, it's not personal, it's capacity. Yep. So excellent conversation, everybody. We need to sign off because we have our members present. Again, if you go into the description, you'll see a library membership sign up. All of you listening, the library membership is $50 a month. You can cancel whenever you want and restart it whenever you want. And there are, right now, I mean, there's dozens. I don't even know how many, dozens and dozens and dozens of 15-minute lectures and practices and movements. All of my webinars are there. We do a monthly sound healing there. We do a Monday and Tuesday live 15-minute session that gets recorded and archived there. And every month we do this, where you can sit with us while we do our podcast. Then we hop off and we do a 30-minute Q&A and little weaving with our community. So you can join the library membership whenever you'd like. And I'll look forward to seeing you again. That's the end of today's episode. Now let's take a moment to notice where we feel the episode in our bodies. Close your eyes. Take a breath. And let whatever wants to come up, come up. And remember, those sensations hold the wisdom that we're looking for. If you want to go deeper, visit holisticlifenavigation.com. Hello, everybody. It is the time of year to begin registering for one or two of my slow groups that begin in July. My slow groups are these special groups where I focus on one topic and we deeply unpack it over the course of 6 months. So these are highly nuanced, deep dive, advanced groups. These are excellent for those of you who have taken my 6-week course or who just want to focus on one particular topic through a somatic and trauma-informed lens. The two that are opening up in July, or will begin in July, are my embodied parenting group and my embodied nutrition group. The embodied parenting group is just like it sounds, learning how to parent from your body, learning how to ground yourself in your parenting so you're not parenting from a reactive, triggered place, but from a much more conscious place so you can actually find joy in your parenting instead of it being a total hellscape like some of you have told me it is and I've experienced it myself. The other group is an embodied nutrition group. This has been requested for years. For the past 4 years after students complete my course, they say, can you please do a course on nutrition and make it longer than 6 weeks? So finally, I can say, yes, you can. And I can. And I did. It is a 6-month unpacking of the intersection between trauma, nutrition, and somatics. How do we recover from stress and trauma via food? How do we relate to food as a being and not just some object on the plate? What's the biochemistry of food? Why is it not the best for my blood sugar to have toast, but lentils are just fine if they're both carbohydrates? All of this and more will be unpacked in this 6-month group. To register for these groups, please go to my website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click groups, or you can click the link in the episode details below. Registration closes on June 1st. It is only open through May because we need the month of June to prepare everybody for July. I'm looking forward to this deep dive with you all. I'll see you there.